I love Election Day. I don't think there's a greater feeling than slamming on some regal classical music and entering the polling booth to take part in the little direct democracy we get in this country. If you're curious, this year I'll be listening to Coronation Anthem No. 1, better known as Zadok the Priest, by Handel, as I've been doing quite a lot of reading about him for an upcoming episode. I've had loads of questions from you guys, so I'm happy to spend this episode answering them. I've not done the traditional call and response style that I've done before, so I'm just going to cover them off as I go. So the polling stations will be open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. on 12th December tomorrow. It may seem strange that we have an election in December, and it is for the most part. Elections tend to be chosen over the summer months as the weather is better and there's more daylight, the most favourable conditions for most people to vote and less discouraging to older voters. The last general election in December was in 1923, which was incredibly interesting for a number of reasons. Last episode we spoke about Bona Law and his pretty bad start to the premiership, and was forced to resign due to suffering from throat cancer that left him unable to speak in the House of Commons. Bona Law died 2 months after the 1923 election. The Conservatives under Stanley Baldwin, who had been Prime Minister after Bona Law resigned in May, won the most seats in the December election. However, the Labour Party under Ramsay MacDonald, as well as the reunited Liberal Party under H.H. Asquith, won a combined majority and formed a coalition. We spoke briefly about the split in the Liberal Party between Asquith and Lloyd George, but this had been sorted out by 1923. More importantly, this is the first Labour government the UK would see. Two other elections in the 20th century occurred in December. 1910 saw H.H. Asquith again lead the Liberals into government through a coalition with the Irish Nationalists, leaving Arthur Balfour and the Conservatives out in the cold. This was another interesting election because it was the last one to take place over 7 days of voting. It was also the last time that the Liberals would see the most majority parliamentary seats won out of all the parties. The times, they were a-changing. The other December election was in 1918 that saw the Liberals in coalition with the Conservatives storm to victory. H.H. Asquith, again, who opposed the coalition, actually lost his seat in East Fife, as did many other Liberals who didn't endorse David Lloyd George's coalition. It's a very interesting election, I can't wait to cover it with you. An often asked question is, why are elections held on a Thursday? There's a number of suggestions and theories that I'll go through. One theory is that elections are held on Thursday so that the Prime Minister can form a cabinet over the weekend and the new government can start business on Monday. Some say that it's for the ease of civil servants working Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m, meaning that they have less disruption to them in organising the handover of government. A plausible suggestion is that Thursday, in most cases, was the traditional market day. As a result of this, most people would be in town and therefore be able to vote in addition to purchasing their wares. My favourite theory is that it dates back to the days when weekly pay was more common. Thursday was chosen because the weekly pay packet wouldn't be handed out until Friday, and it was thus less likely for workers to go out and get drunk with the pay and forget to vote. In reality, it's one of our balmy customs. Local elections for county and district councillors have to be held on the first Thursday of May by law, but this doesn't apply to general elections. European elections are held over a few days, of which the UK is one of the first to vote on a Thursday, and other countries don't vote until Saturday, and some even until Sunday, such as France, Germany and Italy. Remember, as I said, before 1910, voting was held over a week, so out of all the general elections since then, only two of them have been on a day other than Thursday, which was the 1931 election held on Tuesday, and the 1924 election which was held on a Wednesday. I like to think they were trying a few different options out in the early days. Talking about history, I had a great question that I'll slot in here about when party leaders became important in elections. Obviously in this one, Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn have been integral like and dislike topics for voters. I'd argue that the leader isn't as important as it is in the United States, where it's very much a cult of personality. I don't remember it being like that when I was younger, and it's probably an Americanization of our politics. For much of the 1900s, people voted predominantly with their class or for policies of the party. Before that, obviously, only certain people could vote, and I'd have to read more about what influenced them. Even further back than that, we've got a lot of corrupt or rigged elections where you could essentially buy many of the seats in the UK, many known as rotten boroughs, and more on that in an upcoming episode. Sure, the odd leader comes along and wows the country, but based on stats, we vote on policies, the level of failure or success of the incumbent, and sadly, many still vote a certain way because they've always done so. I hope that answers the question in some way, but there's more research for me to do as we go through the history episodes. Now let's get technical on the voting itself. To vote in the general election on the 12th of December, you must be registered to vote, be 18 or over on the day of the election, be a British, Irish or qualifying Commonwealth citizen, be a resident at an address in the UK or a British citizen living abroad who has been registered to vote in the UK for the last 15 years, and not be legally excluded from voting. You do not need to bring any ID to vote, unlike a lot of rubbish being spouted on social media. This is different in Northern Ireland, where you do need to bring ID to vote. This is down to the 2002 Electoral Fraud Northern Ireland Act of Parliament, which was introduced to improve public confidence in the electoral process that was littered with corruption and suspected voting fraud. It worked, where they found 10% of the electoral register to be fraudulent after they did a count after the act was put in. You also don't need to bring your polling card, that would have come through the door to you. This will, however, let you know that you are registered to vote and where you have to go to vote. In the UK, we vote in a number of places, mostly community halls, schools and local government authority buildings. There are some weird and wonderful places that people vote in remote communities, usually, such as a windmill in Sussex, a couple's kitchen in East Yorkshire, a laundrette in Oxford, some bloke's garage was one of them, a pub in Sunderland and a train station in North Yorkshire. When the Isle of Wight Festival is on during an election, people can also vote there. Near where I live, there's a town called Merthyr Tydfil, where a hairdresser's doubled up as a polling station in the last election. Some people will have voted by post, and this would have been registered for by the 26th of November or the 21st of November in Northern Ireland. These people must make sure that their postal vote arrives at the electoral office, usually in the main council building for their area, by 10 p.m. on election night. You basically get a ballot paper, do your business with it, and then stick it in the envelope and post it off. The majority of my family vote by post, and I don't quite understand why. Of course, if you're busy out the country or have an illness, I get it. But if not, I don't know why you'd want to miss the exhilaration of going to the polling station. If you're unable to vote in person, you can ask for someone to vote on your behalf. This is called a proxy vote, and you can apply for a proxy vote under certain circumstances, including if you're away on polling day, if you have a medical issue or disability, or you're not able to vote in person because of work or military service. So those working over Christmas as doctors and nurses, they may ask for a proxy vote as well, or if you're away serving in the military. You can ask someone to act as your proxy as long as they are registered to vote and they're allowed to vote in the type of election taking place and can vote in the polling station stated on your poll card. If your proxy can't get to your polling station, they will need to contact your local electoral registration office to arrange what is called a proxy vote by post. And if you have an emergency of some kind, that means you can't be there in person, you can apply for an emergency proxy vote. But this is something you shouldn't have been aware of before December 4th that's happened as an emergency in order to be eligible for one of those. I was researching this and I didn't know all this, so I thought I'd put it in because I think it's interesting for non-UK listeners. And I don't think even UK listeners would really know this unless they've been through the process. So when we come to the results, the polls will close tomorrow at 10 p.m. and then the counting begins. You'll get an exit poll not long after the close of the polls. This happens, it's a similar thing that happens around the world, exit polls. And this poll uses electoral data collected by people standing outside hundreds of polling stations across the UK, asking those who've just been in how they voted. These are pretty accurate for the obvious closeness they have to the end result and the fact they've just voted and don't really have much reason to lie. Sunderland and Newcastle are in the fight for the first constituency to declare their result. Sunderland South and Houghton have been the first to declare since 1992, except for 2017, where they were pipped to the post by Newcastle. You have to watch the footage of the count. It is a military operation with volunteers throwing boxes of votes down a fireman's chain and into the sorting office. To put it into perspective, in 2015, the vote was announced at 10:48 p.m., only 48 minutes after the polls had closed. This meant that they transported all the boxes from all the polling stations and counted roughly 40,000 votes in less time than it takes to watch an episode of Doctor Who. The results will come in overnight with a good idea of what's happening, probably around about 3 or 4 a.m. The winning party will need 326 seats for a majority, with a total of 650 seats up for grabs. If no party has this, they will need to talk to the other parties and bring in support in what's known as a coalition. The Tories are not currently in a coalition with Arlene Foster's Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland. They're actually in something called a confidence and supply agreement, which is a less formalised agreement than a traditional coalition, although they did have a coalition in 2010 with the Liberal Democrats under Nick Clegg. The first thing I'm going to say to anyone is go on the Who Can I Vote For website and read about your candidates and the manifestos and the parties they represent. Your MP is not only there to vote for you in Westminster, but actively make your area better. Are they going to do the surgeries, little meetings that we have weekly or monthly, campaign for the services in your area, and complete casework for constituents? Or are they going to spend their time living somewhere else and being a friend only to the parliamentary party? MPs should be doing a hell of a lot more work than just voting. I'm also a big fan of a long-lost principle called trusteeship. It's probably a completely different episode, but Edmund Burke came up with a model, and he said, "You choose a member, indeed, but when you have chosen him, he is not a member for Bristol, but he is a member for Parliament. His unbiased opinion, his mature judgment, his enlightened conscience, he ought not to sacrifice to you, to any man, or to any set of men living. Your representative owes you not only his industry, but his judgment, and he betrays instead of serving you if he sacrifices it to your opinion." What I take from that is your MP is there to represent you with his own views that are looking after the best interests of your area. Is the MP and the person you vote for going to do that? So let's go through each party briefly, what they stand for, and what you'll hopefully get if they are elected. I'm going to do England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland with a caveat. I know very little about Northern Ireland and their very different political situation, so please don't hate me, any Northern Ireland listeners. Let's start with Boris Johnson and the Conservatives. Their key points are to pass the withdrawal agreement from the EU before Christmas and get Brexit done by the end of January. Of course, that's only the start, and the actual process is going to take a couple of years. £20.5 billion of extra funding to the NHS, our health system in England, though not to other nations in the United Kingdom, because this is devolved and they set their own funding budgets. And also there's going to be 50,000 more nurses, although this has kind of been torn apart with it being actually 31,500 new nurses and another 18,500 being actually nurses now and encouraged not to quit the profession. So 31,500 extra nurses is still a good amount of new nurses, but retention is not an increase, and it's a bit crooked to claim so. They're also promising 20,000 more police officers for England and Wales over the next 3 years. But remember, these are against the 20,000 that have left the force since 2010 and not been replaced. Again, I've got issue with this. If you have 50 garden gnomes in your front yard and I steal them over a period of 9 years and then give you 50 gnomes for Christmas this year, you'd struggle to call that a gift. Net carbon emissions by 2050 is another policy, which is kind of a pledge that's been reiterated from previous elections. They also want to install a Australian-style point system for immigration, meaning we'll all get the most talented immigrants on paper, supposedly, from anywhere in the world, not just Europe. No more corporation tax cuts have been announced, which may isolate some of the business voters, but there will also be no more rises in income tax, VAT or national insurance contributions, which is one for everyone, I suppose. Now to Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, who are pushing a very different manifesto, as you'd expect, including another Brexit referendum with the vote on Remain or a deal that Jeremy Corbyn will negotiate with Europe. They want to build 100,000 new council homes by 2024 and 250,000 new affordable homes over the next 5 years through housing associations. Also, £400 billion injection of capital into transport, energy, schools, healthcare, housing, and the environment. Next is free full fibre broadband for every home and business in the UK by 2030. I take massive issue with this policy, as there's been no thought for the thousands of jobs in telecoms providers outside of British Telecoms in the UK who will essentially lose their jobs if this happens. They also want to stop pension age rises beyond the current 66 years old and the sorting of the WASPI women crisis, where a number of women born in the 1950s have found themselves without a pension due to a broken promise on raising the pension release age. Finally, and most fantastically of all, £10 an hour minimum wage for all workers, up from the current £8.21. It's worth mentioning that neither of these manifestos are credible from a financial basis, according to the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which is a think tank that's much more respected than either of the leading political parties. Basically, both parties are offering a lot, and there's a gap in where the money is going to come from, as they're both promising not to hike taxes, at least not enough to cover it. Now, on to the parties who could hold the balance of power if neither Labour nor the Tories win enough seats. Remember, the magic number is 326. The Liberal Democrats, under Glasgow-born Joe Swinson, are vying for third or fourth place in the election after a series of unfortunate events and blowouts in elections in 2015, where the party was almost wiped out for promising not to raise tuition fees for students at universities, and then doing it with the Tories in coalition. So, what about the Lib Dems, and what do they want? Well, they want to stop Brexit at all costs, and will do that if they win. They won't win, but that's their stance. Free childcare for all children aged 2 to 4 for 35 hours per week for 48 weeks of the year. This has been criticised as it looks like it's actually going to benefit middle class families as opposed to working class families. There's a brilliant interview on Women's Hour where Joe Swinson basically gets ripped apart for it. They're going to put income tax up by 1p in every pound to invest in the NHS and social care. For someone on £30,000 a year, that's another £300 in tax per year. There's going to be £20 billion a year to tackle climate change. And finally, more teachers, 20,000 to be exact, and the raising of school funding to £10.6 billion by 2024. There is a group called the Independent Group for Change, which was a splinter group from the Labour Party led by Anna Sowbury, but I actually can't be bothered to waste either of our time explaining them, as they're probably going to get wiped out in this election. The same goes for UKIP, Nigel Farage's former stomping ground. I can't see them doing anything sizeable without Brexit's poster child as their leader, and we'll talk about Brexit Party in a minute, and to be honest, UKIP's manifesto isn't far off that. The Green Party is led by a duo, Jonathan Bartley and Sean Berry. As you'd expect, they're all about the environment. It will be interesting, with all the action from Extinction Rebellion and the talk about 10 years to save the world, whether people will actually lend their votes to the Greens. I'll talk about that in a bit. The Greens want, on Brexit, they want another referendum. They want net zero carbon emissions by 2030. Remember, the Tories and Liberal Democrats made the promise a few years ago of doing this by 2050. So this is ambitious. They want to put £1 trillion over the next decade to tackle climate change, most of this coming from borrowing from international banks and international sources. And then also promising over 1 million new jobs through green investment. And the last choice for England are the populist bad boys at the Brexit Party. Led by Nigel Farage, they've got a pretty one policy manifesto, which, as you can probably expect, is about leaving the EU and all its institutions, and without a deal, what we like to call a clean break or a hard Brexit. But it's not all about Brexit. Well, actually it is. They want to also have a free trade deal with the EU by 2020, similar to Canada, which actually took Canada a decade to organise. And if the deal can't be done, they want to move to World Trade Organization trading rules to maintain free trade across the world. They want a ban on the UK exporting waste, forcing the UK to deal with its own waste problem. It's quite responsible. And just to show they're not all about Brexit, they've slapped £200 billion into a fund for infrastructure, young people's services and free broadband in deprived regions, as well as free Wi-Fi on public transport. Now to Wales, where I'll be voting this year. The only additional party here is Plaid Cymru, Wales's National Party, led by the bushiest pair of eyebrows in politics, Mr. Adam Price. The other parties do have regional leaders here, but Plaid will be the only one to compete in only Welsh constituencies. They will, if elected, give the UK a second referendum on Brexit. They want to electrify Wales's main rail lines by 2030, which I imagine in South Wales will be the line from Swansea to London going through Cardiff and Newport, and then in the north will be the main line from Holyhead to Crewe in England. Personally, I think the fact that it takes 3 hours by train to travel from Swansea to Merthyr Tydfil is more important as an example of how disjointed the rail system is in Wales. And lastly, they want 1% of GDP donated to green investments over a decade, as well as £20 billion for Welsh green jobs and infrastructure. And now to the Bonnie Highlands of Scotland to cover the SNP, or the Scottish National Party, under Nicola Sturgeon. They've got a pretty strong base in Scotland, much more than Plaid Cymru have in Wales. And this election, they are promising a referendum on Scottish independence in 2020, while at the same time wanting to stay in the EU, potentially via a referendum. I've drawn issues with this stance for a while now, and will happily take emails on anyone who knows the logical answer. The SNP want to leave the British Union that they've been part of for hundreds of years, before we started the History in Our podcast, but at the same time, they want to leave the European Union, where there's a whole bunch of irony, in my opinion, to leave one union but stay in another. We're stronger together as long as they're French and German and not English and Welsh. Again, I don't get it. The SNP also wants stronger devolution to the Scottish Holyrood Parliament and an end to Conservative austerity cuts that have been in place since 2010. This includes devolution of the Scottish part of the National Rail train line to Scotland and the Scottish government. They want a ban on unpaid trial shifts and the scrapping of tiered minimum wage based on age. In the UK, you get paid less if you're under 25 and on minimum wage. They also want to replace the House of Lords with an elected second chamber and allowing 16 and 17 year olds to vote in the UK elections to match the franchise that is offered in Scottish elections. Now to Northern Ireland. Believe it or not, there's 6 parties standing in Northern Ireland, and none of them are franchises of English parties. So the people in Northern Ireland can't directly vote for Jeremy Corbyn or Boris Johnson, which I've always found bizarre. I'll wrap this up quite quickly, so here we go. Arlene Foster leads the DUP, or the Democratic Unionist Party, which we've already mentioned is currently in a confidence supply agreement with the Tories. They want to protect the union between the British mainland and Northern Ireland. They want to leave the EU with Northern Ireland. They oppose the Irish backstop and trade barriers between the UK. And finally, they want more jobs through extra powers to Northern Ireland Parliament, known as Stormont. Must be difficult to call for more powers to Stormont when it hasn't actually been in session for 3 years because none of the parties can come to a decision about sharing government. The next largest party is Sinn Féin, who are renowned for vacating their parliamentary seats in protest of the union and refusing to recognise the UK as having authority over Ireland. They oppose Brexit. They want a referendum on a united Ireland where the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland join together. And they want to achieve a zero carbon society. The Alliance Party is a centralist party similar to the Liberal Democrats, representing liberal and moderate views in Northern Ireland. They formed during the heavy conflicts in the 1970s and the Northern Irish Troubles, where there was fierce political splits between unionists and those vying for Irish reunification, often leading to bloody violence. The Alliance Party won a second referendum and the stopping of a hard Brexit. They want an investment in healthcare, jobs and education, and they want the restoration of Stormont that, as we've said, hasn't been passing any legislation for the people of Northern Ireland for the last 3 years. The Green Party in Northern Ireland is separate to the English one but works in cooperation like many other Green parties across Europe. They've been going since the 1980s and they want similar things to their English counterparts. They want to remain in the EU through a people's vote or second referendum. They want a wealth tax on the richest in society and they want to restore Stormont. The Social Democratic and Labour Party, or SDLP, was one of the most popular nationalist parties wanting reunification of the North and South during the violence of the Troubles in the 1970s and 80s, but has sort of been sidelined since the Good Friday Agreement and the IRA ceasefire in 1997 in favour of Sinn Féin. They hold no seats in the UK Parliament currently, but they will be standing on a mandate for the revocation of Article 50 through their catchy manifesto title, Stop Boris, Stop Brexit. It kind of reminds me of Heroes, you know, that Save the Cheerleader, Save the World. I'm sure that was second choice. They want to restore Stormont. They want to be carbon neutral by 2030. They want to reform the benefits system. And they want to push for payments to victims of the Northern Irish Troubles and the preventing of an amnesty for those who committed sectarian violence over the last few decades. And last, the Ulster Unionist Party, or the UUP, who are essentially the Conservatives in Northern Ireland, but they don't have any seats either. They want to prioritise the union of the UK over Brexit and move to direct rule by Westminster if Stormont and devolution isn't restored by January. This is actually also a policy of the Alliance Party as well, if it's not reached by January 13th, I believe. They want to declare a healthcare emergency as well, and this is a really important point for Northern Irish voters. It's really bad in Northern Ireland at the moment compared to the rest of the UK. There are some patients waiting over 4 years for a first appointment. There's 300,000 people waiting to see consultants. And more disgustingly, and I mean this is shocking, 1 in 5 cancer diagnoses are discovered when patients arrive at A&E, probably because they're in a later stage of the cancer. A third of lung cancer diagnoses are done in A&E. For our American listeners, A&E, or Accident and Emergency Department, is a bit like your ER, but there isn't a George Clooney there. And finally, for the UUP, they oppose a historical investigations unit being set up to investigate offences committed during the Troubles. And that's everyone. I know what you're going to ask. How am I going to vote? Well, to be honest, and this is being completely honest with you, I haven't decided yet. And interestingly, 10% of men and 20% of women are still undecided on how they're going to vote, which is a bit crazy to me, as I feel this is a really difficult election choice, and I thought a few more people would still be pondering it. It will be a last-minute decision for me, like it was in 2017, and I talk more about this in our Q&A episode from last season. One question I've been asked is, what happens if you like your MP because they've done a good job, but you don't like the leader of the party or the party itself? Sadly, it's a bit of a like-it-or-lump-it situation. I know Conservative voters in my constituency who are voting Labour because we've got a hard-working MP who's completed almost 4,000 pieces of casework in just 2 years. Then again, where I'm from, people I know who are dumping the Tories and an MP who's done some good work in the area to vote Labour to get a second referendum. Your MP, more often than not, is going to do what the leader says, because if they don't, they risk being deselected or moved out of the safe seat to the dreaded marginals. All I can say is make sure that if you can vote, you do. And make sure you read the full policies, not just this breakdown or things you see on Facebook or Twitter. Vote for the party that is going to make yours and your family's life better. Who's the most competent? Don't vote Tory because your dad does. Don't vote Labour as you like the colour red. Vote with conscience and conviction. It's only 5 years, so don't worry if you get it wrong. In fact, you can't get it wrong. That's the great thing about democracy. But make sure you do vote. Make sure you vote for the people who are going to make your lives better, or you think are going to make your lives better. And if we get it wrong, we can kick them out in 5 years. There's a couple of great websites you can go on and have a look at the policies and answer a quiz, and it will tell you which policies of each party you would most support. There's a great one I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, and there's one now I mentioned, which is isidewith.com. Great little quiz, and it will tell you where you sit on all the policies. Right, who wants some predictions? I've relied on the same couple of polls over the last few years and haven't been too wrong. People often say don't trust polls. I disagree, and I say don't trust the wrong polls. Politics and predictions become a lot easier if you can read the data. John Curtis, the political analyst and professor at Strathclyde University, isn't a god. He's an economist who reads the right polls. Personally, I use three. I use DeltaPol, YouGov and Lord Ashcroft's pollsters to collate across the three and decide who's going to win. I use DeltaPol as I like the layout and the questions they ask. One of their biggest clients for the data is the Mail on the Sunday, which is a newspaper, but I don't hold that against them. They canvassed a size of around about 1,500 people across the country of various past party voting habits and split almost equally on Leave and Remain, stating whether they were a Tory Leaver or a Labour Leaver, and the same for Remain. On the actual voting, the Tories sit about 44% and Labour at 33%. Lib Dems are way behind on 11% and Brexit on 3%. This is pretty interesting, even from a small data set, that we're probably not going to see the Brexit Party surge, especially as they're not competing against Tory-held constituencies. The only place they're really seeing a surge is Wales, where we'll probably see some Labour seats go to Tory and maybe Brexit. We may see Plaid Cymru lose vote share, and maybe one of their two seats to the Brexit Party, where their Remain stance is wholly opposite to the majority of Welsh people who voted to leave the EU. There are many areas in Wales, like Merthyr Tydfil, that voted heavily to leave, but feel unrepresented by Labour. However, due to a fierce hatred of the Tories in the area, due to some of the actions of Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, amongst some, it's unlikely we'll ever see it go blue. From my knowledge and opinion of Wales, Labour will come out on top with the most number of seats in Wales, but there will be Tory gains. I can see Gower, my constituency, going back to the Tories that Labour won from them in 2017. They'll most likely win back Brecon and Radnorshire from the Lib Dems, who gained it in a by-election early this year after the incumbent Tory MP was convicted of faking invoices to claim expenses. Tories perform pretty statically at the 40% mark across all areas of the UK, except Scotland, where they're with Labour at just under 20%. Half the voters in Scotland are saying SNP. It's not unsurprising that they'll hold quite a few of their seats. The SNP actually do a half-decent job of running the Scottish Government, so it's probably unlikely we're going to see a massive shift. On polling views of the leaders, which has played a big role in this election, Boris Johnson walks away with a 52% approval rating when looking at those who viewed him as doing the job well against him doing it badly. Corbyn sits at 28% approval rate and Joe Swinson of the Lib Dems at 24%. Nigel Farage of the Brexit Party comes in at 32%. It looks like the Joe Swinson charm really hasn't taken off, especially in Scotland, her home country, and looks like they'll be taking around 11% of the vote. But I wouldn't sniff at that. They took just over 7% of the vote in 2015 and 2017 election, largely due to the supporting of Tories on the bedroom tax, and again, as I mentioned, the raising of tuition fees after promising they wouldn't. I mean, they were literally wiped out, going from 57 seats in 2010 to just 8 in 2015. They were hit even harder in local elections in 2014, losing more than 300 councillors and control of two local governments. What the polls show is that they are on the rise again, slowly. Will they get back to the heady heights of 23% vote share under Charles Kennedy and Nick Clegg? It's certainly going that way, but the British public are a fickle bunch. If former mining communities still won't vote Conservative because of Thatcher, well, you can bet that there's a couple of million students who will hold a grudge for a pretty long shelf life. YouGov is probably my favourite poll because the polling database is so large. They use an MRP model, which stands for Multi-Level Regression and Post-Stratification. And in the data I'm looking at, conducted over 100,000 interviews over 7 days. I've taken a snip from their website explaining how the model works. It works by modelling vote intention based on analysis of key demographics as well as voting behaviour in the 2016 EU referendum, the 2017 general election and the 2019 European Parliament elections. Each day, YouGov conducted approximately 14,000 interviews with registered voters from our panel who are shown just the parties and the candidates running in their particular seat. This data is used to access how voters are making choices across the many different types of constituency in Britain, using information about the voters in each constituency, as well as the sets of candidates who are standing in the different constituencies. From this, the model calculates voting intention and seat estimates. Now, this came out yesterday and YouGov are estimating 43% of the vote going to the Tories, Labour coming in at 32%. If this happens, you're looking at 359 seats to the Conservatives and 211 to Labour, with Lib Dems taking 13. That gives the Tories a majority of 28 if all the other parties vote against them. The SNP retain most of their seats in the north of Scotland, with Tory gains across the west of the border and Labour keeping a safe hold on the east coast. Labour look to remain in urban areas and cities, with the Tories winning almost every southern and midland coastal seat, along with a large swathe of the home counties, as you'd expect. And finally, the Lord Ashcroft polls. Over 4,000 interviews between the 5th and 9th of December show a clear Conservative lead. Quoting from his website, lordashcroftpolls.com, which is definitely worth a visit due to the pretty graphs and diagrams, it says, "When we force people to choose between a Conservative government, Boris Johnson as PM, and a Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn, we find Tory lead of 8%, 54% to 46%, down slightly from the 10 points lead last week. Labour leavers now break 58% to 42% in favour of Labour and Corbyn, compared to the 54% to 46% in favour of Johnson and the Conservatives in the first week of the campaign. 2017 Tory Remainers favour a Johnson-led Conservative government by 83% to 17%, down slightly from the 86% to 14% last week." A lot of people are talking about tactical voting on a scale not many have seen before amongst Remain voters to try and keep the Tories and hard Brexit out. But if I'm honest, I can't see it happening. John Curtis has said it's possible that it could scupper the Tory majority, which he predicts is going to be around 14. Tactical voting is like the prisoner's dilemma. Everyone needs to be informed on the plan and stick to it. It's hard enough to get two people to do that, let alone 2 million or more. My overall prediction is this. The Conservatives are likely to get a majority, and I'd personally suggest that it won't be as many as YouGov's 28. It will probably be more than John Curtis's 14, and I'd probably say it'll be around 20 or so. The Lib Dems will make minimal gains, and Labour will lose a number of seats across the UK. Although what I will say is polls today are showing that although the Conservatives are at the same levels of support as they were at the very beginning of the election campaign, Labour is up slightly from the beginning, mainly making gains from the Lib Dems. The Brexit Party will fail to win more than one or two seats from Labour, and maybe from Plaid Cymru, but again, that's going to be a push. Of course, we're seeing some last-minute big stories where Labour have picked up Lib Dem vote share. The Green Party will fail to make any seat gains, but will certainly increase the vote share this election in wake of Extinction Rebellion and the climate crisis. It is unlikely they will lose their seat in Brighton and Hove. The SNP will continue to hold out in Scotland. I'm not skilled enough to speak about Northern Ireland, but in Wales, where I am, you will see Labour on top, with at least one Plaid Cymru loss, in my opinion, and a few Conservative gains. Of course, I can't prove my predictions to you, but I was firmly of the belief that Trump would win, as well as being on the right side of the last four elections. I will admit, Brexit even took me by surprise, despite everyone I know saying they were going to vote out, which was, to be honest at the time, a pretty good indication. If I'm wrong, I'll take the flak. I'm happy to be wrong on this, as it gives me a chance to learn from the holes in the polls where I can improve on the next load of predictions. But I'm not a pollster, but no one likes anyone who sits on the fence. So this is what I think is going to happen. All I'll say is put money on the Tory majority. If you want a tip, try Gower, Canterbury and Bridgend to go Conservative from Labour. I can see the Lib Dems winning back Sheffield Hallam, Nick Clegg's old seat, after Jared O'Mara, a disastrous Labour candidate, now independent, has upset a wide portion of the community. And finally, I'd be inclined to take a stab at Perth and North Perthshire in Scotland, going from SNP to the Conservatives. But with the Labour majority at 20-1 in the bookies, that's probably worth a pound for a laugh as well. One final plug for the competition we're running that will be announced as the exit polls are released on Thursday. Courtesy of the great people at House Publishing, I've got three copies of a brilliant book that I'm looking at right now by Jack Brown, who we had on last season to talk about Number 10 Downing Street and the building and the people who lived inside it. Number 10, The Geography of Power at Downing Street, is a fantastic book that looks at modern-day prime ministers, the building, and a lot of new information about how British political power operates from within a small, unassuming building in central London. I've got three copies to give away, and one of them will have a £20 Amazon gift card in it just in time for Christmas. All you need to do is let me know your favourite Prime Minister and why. Email it over to chris@notempo.com or reply on our pinned tweet on Number 10 Podcast on Twitter, or search No Tempo on Facebook and let us know there. I do have one very exciting final thing to say. Unfortunately, unlike many elections of the past couple of years, I stay up and watch the whole thing. But due to a very busy time at work and being unable to take any time off, I'm not going to be able to do that. So Mrs. Number 10, who is a journalist by trade and has spent the last two or three elections slumming it in official counts in council buildings across South Wales, has offered to do a live tweet of the entire election, or as long as she can stay awake for, throughout the night, with a little bit of commentary from her knowledge as well. I will probably be around for some of it before falling unconscious, and then I might be there for some of the early hours stuff as well before I head off to work. It's going to be an interesting election, so if you are up, please do check us out on Twitter, where we'll be putting out plenty of information on the night. Have a lovely week, the rest of the week, and happy voting. If you are voting, if you can vote, you must vote, and we will speak to you soon. Bye-bye.